the CBS News Weekend Roundup, coming up next.
Guys, if you're into fantasy football, you've got to check out FanDuel.com. At FanDuel, you play in one-week fantasy football leagues for real money with immediate cash payouts. You only play when you want, and you can change your team any week. FanDuel's paying out over $10 million every week this season. And right now, FanDuel is giving you up to $200 free. That's right. For every dollar you deposit, FanDuel will match it up to $200. Just go to FanDuel.com, click the microphone in the upper right corner, and enter code FOOTBALL70. FANDUEL.com. Code FOOTBALL, the number 70.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with background and analysis from the correspondents who cover the news. And now from Washington, here's CBS News national correspondent Dan Revie.
Our government wants us to believe the danger of getting Ebola virus is very low, but authorities are taking Ebola very seriously. We'll report, including controversies, some of them political. Later, an electric fan caused an uproar at a campaign debate in Florida. CBS's Wyatt Andrews will report it's between Governor Rick Scott and former Governor Charlie Crist.
Both men were asked to air this out. Crist shrugged it off as no big deal.
Is there anything wrong with being comfortable?
And a grim story, the woman in Oregon who plans to use her legal right to take a lethal dose. To escape the pain of a brain tumor, she tells CBS's Jan Crawford it's not suicide, it's cancer ending her life.
I am choosing to end it a little sooner and in a lot less pain and suffering.
You'll hear Brittany Maynard and a lot more news on this weekend roundup. Please stay tuned. But first, word came on Friday that President Obama has chosen one person to coordinate the federal government response to that virus from West Africa. The president used the informal job title Ebola Czar. Getting that job, Ron Klain, a lawyer who has served the Democratic Party. He was portrayed by actor Kevin Spacey in the HBO film Recount. Klain was chief of staff to two vice presidents. He's not a doctor. White House spokesman Josh Earnest said,
"What we were looking for is not an Ebola expert, but rather an implementation expert."
Adding that Klain is likely to have that job for 5 or 6 months. With reactions, CBS News reporter Allison Keyes.
New York Democratic Senator Charles Schumer was quick to issue a statement calling Klain smart, level-headed, and an excellent choice. But Republican Congressman Tim Murphy disagrees.
This is someone who has zero epidemiological experience, zero disease management experience. This is wrong. This is shocking, and it shouldn't happen.
He says Klain has zero medical experience, and a political appointee shouldn't be in charge of one of the deadliest diseases we've known.
Murphy on Thursday had chaired a House hearing on Ebola, where CBS News congressional correspondent Nancy Cordes reported Dr. Tom Frieden was under pressure to recommend that all travel from West Africa be banned.
The CDC director went head-to-head with Republicans, Fred Upton of Michigan.
We should not be allowing these folks in, period.
But Dr. Frieden argued that would make Americans less safe.
There is a high likelihood that they will find another way to get here, and we won't be able to track them.
The head of Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas testified by video phone. Dr. Daniel Varga admitted his staff had not been trained to spot or treat Ebola before Thomas Eric Duncan arrived in the ER.
In our initial treatment of Mr. Duncan, despite our best intentions and a highly skilled medical team, we made mistakes. We did not correctly diagnose his symptoms as those of Ebola, and we are deeply sorry.
You heard how the hospital administrator in Dallas, on a scratchy connection to Congress, apologized. Apparent mistakes were made in how the Ebola patient from Liberia was treated before he died in that hospital. President Obama also referred to that.
We are reviewing every step so that we understand exactly where some of the problems may have occurred.
The president at the White House on Wednesday. Then on Thursday, when he urged everyone to keep things in perspective, the chance of an average American getting Ebola, he said, is very, very low.
I understand that people are worried. This is a disease that is new to our shores, although it is something that has cropped up periodically in other countries because of the virulence of the disease and the way it's transmitted and the symptoms that occur. I understand that people are scared.
Two nurses who got Ebola while treating Thomas Duncan before he died were flown out of Dallas. Nina Pham moved to the National Institutes of Health here in the Washington, D.C. area. And Amber Vinson flown to Emory University Hospital in Atlanta, where patients have been successfully treated. Around 800 people more were brought into the web of possible Ebola contamination when it became known that Vincent spent last weekend in Ohio visiting relatives to make plans for her wedding. CDC Director Dr. Tom Frieden highlighted another mistake.
She should not have traveled on a commercial airline.
Vincent did not know she'd contracted Ebola. She did have a bit of a fever. Frontier Airlines felt it had to inform everyone on her two flights and five more flights made by that aircraft before it was grounded and sprayed thoroughly with antiseptic. Rick Salinger of CBS TV station KCNC in Denver reported.
The Airbus 320 was flown from Cleveland here to Denver with only a crew on board. The airline CEO has emailed employees telling them that the plane has been thoroughly sanitized, with some seat covers and carpeting being removed. Six crew members have been placed on paid leave for 21 days as a precaution. Rick Salinger, CBS News, Denver.
Ebola scares occurred elsewhere at college campuses, on a cruise ship, in a parking lot at the Pentagon. Almost anywhere when a person had high fever or vomiting and said she or he had been in West Africa. CBS News medical correspondent Dr. John LaPook reported Tuesday that certainly in that region, an Ebola epidemic is growing.
The World Health Organization said that by December 1st, the region could see 5 to 10,000 new cases every week.
Although previous estimates put the mortality rate at about 50%, a more accurate number is now felt to be closer to 70%.
The number of deaths from Ebola in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea is approaching 5,000. In Liberia's capital, Monrovia, CBS's Deborah Patta met Kathy Miner from New Jersey, who works for a charity that donated an ambulance.
The ambulance is able to carry the sick out very quickly here. In other communities, it can take up to 3-4 days before an ambulance arrives. For us, it's 30 minutes. Do you know anything about Ebola? You know it's
Myla runs a school, but with all classes cancelled now.
Wash your hands. What else? What
she
else?
Turned her school into an outreach center. She believes it's the only way the disease will be stopped.
You got sickness around, so be extra careful.
Dr. Dan Lucy is from Georgetown University and is one of the world's top virologists. He works at a clinic run by Doctors Without Borders. Lucy told us about a family he helped treat who brought their three-year-old who was going to die.
Fortunately, both her mom and dad were here, but they were also both quite sick. But then they recovered adequately and took turns. The mom and dad took turns helping the three-year-old daughter. And now today it's one of the best days of my life because they're survived.
Also in Liberia, ramping up their efforts to build a treatment center and transport medical supplies, hundreds of U.S. troops, with more being sent in. President Obama explained,
"Probably the single most important thing that we can do to prevent a more serious Ebola outbreak in this country is making sure that we get what is a raging epidemic right now in West Africa under control."
And
I am absolutely confident that we can prevent a serious outbreak of the disease here in the United States.
Up next, a woman with cancer determined to end her own life speaks to CBS News.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Revive.
Now a story that's painful to report, but thought-provoking. The woman who may never reach age 30, planning suicide by overdose to avoid pain and suffering from her terminal brain cancer, probably within a few weeks. Brittany Maynard is on the cover of People magazine, and she did her first television interview on CBS This Morning. She spoke with correspondent Jan Crawford.
I don't want to die. If anyone wants to hand me, like, a magical cure and save my life so that I can have children with my husband, you know, I will take them up on it.
She's 29 years old, recently married, and was hoping to start a family. Now, Brittany Maynard is planning her death, choosing to end her life before cancer can destroy her.
I think until anyone has walked a mile in my shoes and knows what they're facing and has felt the, like, just bone-splitting headaches that I get sometimes, or the seizures, or the inability to speak, or the moments where I'm looking at my husband's face and I can't think of his name,
Maynard found out this spring she has the most lethal form of brain cancer and says doctors told her she may only have 6 months to live. Her medication has drastically changed her appearance, but she's decided to forego aggressive treatment and die, as she puts it, with dignity.
Did you have any pushback from your mother or your family?
I think it took my family a little while to realize that this is what made sense, because no one wants to hear that their daughter is going to die. No mother should have to lose a child. And it, like, goes against the grain of nature.
And so many would say, I just want one more day. You know, not,
yes.
don't end it.
But my mother is not
to.
Selfish enough to say, I want one more day where you're suffering.
Maynard was raised by her mom, a single mother in Southern California. She had an adventurous spirit and loved to travel. With degrees in psychology and education, she planned to be a teacher.
It seems like now when she's thinking about her death, part of the reason she's thinking about this is also because of the people around her that she loves.
Early on, I told her, it would be my honor to take care of you, whichever way. If you need to be fed or diapered.
Because that's what mothers do. You take care of your little girl.
That was important for me, for her to know.
Did you just think, no, I want her to be here for as long as, even if she's in bed sick, I can lie down with her.
There's absolutely that. The idea of wanting my wife to be at my side forever. That was the original plan, right? But I guess that feeds into the argument of quality of life versus just quantity.
Maynard said she's choosing quality. After her diagnosis, she moved to Portland, Oregon, one of 5 states where it's legal for doctors to help terminally ill patients take their own lives. She decided to partner with the leading organization that's pushing other states to change their laws.
I know that it's there when I need it.
She even talked about plans for a specific day to end her life, November 1st, 6 days after her husband's birthday.
So November 1st became kind of a date for me to almost like make it to.
It was a goal.
Yeah.
Not a deadline. Where,
that's the idea, and that's a huge misconception, and I feel like people who are against this healthcare choice have tried to make it into a deadline, and I may be alive on November 2nd, or I may not, and that's my choice.
So to the people who would say, well, you're choosing to end your life, that's suicide, you would say, no, it's
what? No, cancer is ending my life. I am choosing to end it a little sooner and in a lot less pain and suffering.
Brittany Maynard telling her story to CBS News correspondent Jan Crawford in Oregon, where the state law for the so-called right to die took effect 17 years ago. Since then, more than 1,000 people have gotten prescriptions from doctors for drugs to end their life. Just over half have taken the pills and are gone. Now the American threatened with death by beheading in an ISIS video. Peter Kasig converted to Islam while doing aid work in the Middle East, now known as Abdul Rahman Kasig. His parents in Indianapolis, Ed and Paula, deeply worried, broke their silence, speaking with CBS News correspondent Margaret Brennan.
We couldn't answer honestly when people would ask us. So we had to lie to our friends.
The recent murder of American journalist Stephen Sotloff, Kasig's cellmate at one point, prompted the Kasigs to make a public plea for help.
The dynamics have changed now. Stephen's family kept the secrecy, and he was executed. Peter's name has been listed.
How did you find out that he had been captured?
A phone call, and it was Peter's number. And I thought, oh, man, I get to hear from Peter. And when I picked up the phone, I didn't recognize the voice.
Once the video appeared showing their son being threatened by ISIS, Ed and Paula retreated to a hotel to avoid the media. Ed described his reaction one morning at breakfast when images of his son flashed across the TV.
One minute, you look at your scrambled eggs, and you look up, it's football. The next minute, you look at scrambled eggs, you look up, and there's your son. And you sit there, and you have to watch. Everybody's jaw in the place drop. And then you got to fake it too, because you don't want to stand there and look callous. And inside, you just want to scream, hey, that's my kid.
The Cassigs revealed for the first time that they received a horrifying audio recording of their son 2 weeks ago. He said his life was in jeopardy if U.S. airstrikes don't stop.
Ed and Paula Cassig spoke with CBS's Margaret Brennan. What do we think of our institutions, such as public schools, banks, churches, Congress? A CBS News poll finds the three branches of the government are at the bottom of the list when the public is asked, do you have confidence in them? Confidence in Congress? 9%. In the presidency, 29%. In the Supreme Court, 30%. Do you have confidence in America's banks? Only 29%. Sarah Dutton is the CBS News Director of Surveys.
Public schools have dropped 21 points since 1973. Banks have dropped by 22 points since 1984. Churches or organized religion is another institution that's experienced a 20-point drop compared to 1973.
Yes, from that year of the Watergate scandal, public confidence has declined sharply. How about government agencies? Do you think they're doing a good or excellent job? The FBI is the only agency getting a majority yes, 51%. The Department of Homeland Security, 43% think it's doing a good or excellent job. In the fight against Ebola, the Centers for Disease Control?
Only 37% of Americans said that the CDC does an excellent or good job, and in fact 60%, far more, say the job it does is just fair or poor.
Our pollster, Sarah Dutton. Up next, an electric fan fans political controversy.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The CBS News Weekend Roundup, after this short break.
Cloud may be just another overused buzzword, but the cloud is an effective computing environment that can save your business time and money. Barracuda Networks is no stranger to the cloud. In fact, all of our security and storage solutions connect to the cloud for continuous updates and off-site redundancy. Barracuda's cloud also plays host to our email security, web security, file sharing, and e-signing services. We even offer solutions on Amazon's AWS and Microsoft's Azure public cloud platforms. To try any of our cloud-connected solutions free, visit barracuda.com/cloud.
Guys, if you're into fantasy football, you've got to check out FanDuel.com. At FanDuel, you play in one-week fantasy football leagues for real money with immediate cash payouts. You only play when you want, and you can change your team any week. FanDuel's paying out over $10 million every week this season. And right now, FanDuel is giving you up to $200 free. That's right, for every dollar you deposit, FanDuel will match it up to $200. Just go to FanDuel.com, click their microphone in the upper right corner, and enter code FOOTBALL70. FANDUEL.com. Code FOOTBALL, the number 70.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Revie.
On Wednesday and again Thursday, President Obama canceled out-of-town trips he had planned, mostly for Democratic Party campaigning. He stayed at the White House and met with top advisors on Ebola. That led to his appointing attorney Ron Klain, a well-known Democrat, as the so-called Ebola czar. The president has not been featured at any big rallies for Democrats running in the November 4th elections. Now his appearance with Connecticut's governor, who's seeking another term, will have to be rescheduled. CBS News White House correspondent Peter Mayer reported.
Southern Connecticut State University political expert Arthur Paulson says Governor Daniel Malloy's campaign hopes the president will rally the troops.
They want to get Democrats to the polls, and Obama is a great motivator.
While many Senate Democratic candidates have distanced themselves from the president, Connecticut's governor needs a boost in a tight rematch against Republican Tom Foley. Peter Mayer, CBS News, The White House.
Another governor's race was in a bizarre spotlight this past week. In Florida, the incumbent, Republican Rick Scott, challenged by a former governor, Charlie Crist, who's also a former Republican, now a Democrat. Crist is known for having an electric fan keeping him cool. At a debate against Scott, Crist had a fan plugged in under his podium, and that, as CBS's Wyatt Andrews reports, prompted a long delay.
Governor of Florida.
For more than 6 minutes, Florida's debate for governor looked like bad reality television.
We have an extremely peculiar situation right now.
Charlie Crist came on stage all alone as the incumbent governor, Republican Rick Scott, staged a no-show protest over a fan that Crist had installed to stay cool. To the Scott campaign, the fan was not cool, a violation of the rules, as moderator Elliot Rodriguez explained.
Somehow there is a fan there, and for that reason, ladies and gentlemen, I am being told that Governor Scott will not join us for this debate.
Governor Scott quickly ended his holdout, but both men were asked to air this out. Crist shrugged it off as no big deal.
Well, is there anything wrong with being comfortable?
But then the governor claimed that he had been late because of Crist.
Well, I waited until we figured out if he was going to show up. He said he wasn't going to come to the debate. So why come out until he's ready?
Florida's newspapers called it fangate, but behind everything here is overheated politics. Republicans were hoping to embarrass Crist, releasing photos of what they called Crist's obsession with fans, sometimes two fans, as he fends off the Florida heat. Governor Scott then used that to suggest Crist can't take the heat.
I think he was sweaty and he needed a fan. I'm surprised he didn't try to ask for dry ice.
But Democrats believe that it was the governor who melted down, to partisans on both sides delaying a debate over a fan and doing that on TV is among the most awkward political moments of the year.
CBS's Wyatt Andrews. Now, the fight against ISIS. American planes have been bombing ISIS fighters in Syria, estimating a few hundred killed in and around Kobani, the city abandoned by many Kurdish residents who are now living in tents on the Turkish side of the border. CBS's Cammie McCormick reported on Friday.
General Lloyd Austin says Kobani is not a diversion. The fight there between ISIS and the Kurds has presented the U.S. with new targeting opportunities. The more the U.S. takes the enemy out, the less likely it will be to regroup elsewhere, he says.
I believe that he made a decision several days ago that Kobani was going to be his main effort. As long as he pours legions of forces there into that area, we'll stay focused on taking them out.
In Iraq, however, ISIS continues to make gains in the West, and bad weather in that country has hampered U.S. airstrikes. Cammie McCormick, CBS News, The Pentagon.
One way Islamic militants fight back in Iraq, suicide car bombings blamed for 50 deaths in Baghdad this past Thursday. CBS's Elizabeth Palmer spent the week with Iraqi troops.
General Jabar Naima says the militants are local men who have a huge advantage over his troops drawn from across the country.
They are knowing everything about their area. Yeah. But the soldiers know nothing.
Yeah. That's tough.
It's a bad time for the Iraqi military. Every soldier here knows the army's been routed by ISIS time and again. But General Jabbar is one of a select group of commanders the U.S. and Iraqi governments hope will turn things around. He studied at the U.S. Army War College in Pennsylvania, and he's learned a thing or two about morale in a climate of defeat.
I should be very close to my soldiers. My soldiers should be very close to each other. They should know how to treat their enemy.
They all have to stay close to the local people who know better than anyone who's planting IEDs or hiding guns. The strategy is working. After months of heavy fighting, Iraqi forces south of Baghdad managed to push ISIS out. But only with backup from U.S. airstrikes 3 weeks ago, which forced the militants to retreat over the bridge, blowing it up behind them.
Elizabeth Palmer reporting from Iraq. Let's turn to John Nagel, a retired lieutenant colonel who fought Saddam Hussein's Iraqi army in two Gulf Wars, co-author of the U.S. military's counterinsurgency manual, now author of a book on military strategy called Knife Fights. John Nagel, the enemy now is ISIS, and the U.S. is propping up the Iraqi government.
A government that the United States spent more than $1 trillion and more than 5,000 American lives working to establish. And that government is struggling right now against the challenge of ISIS. Bad government in Iraq, very sectarian government, actually did some things that hurt the fighting power of its own army. And as a result, even with American air power in support of that Iraqi army, they're not making a whole lot of progress against ISIS, and in fact, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria is within artillery range of the main Baghdad airport right now.
You write about a situation you considered when U.S. troops were there, and it was that question about when you actually capture a location, can you clear it and move on, or do you have to hold it? Is that part of the challenge now for Iraq's army?
It absolutely is. So the Iraqi army is struggling with the first part, the clear hold, build counterinsurgency strategy that begins with pushing the enemy, the visible enemy, out of an area. You then have to do the really hard part of winkling out the insurgents hiding like fish among the sea of the people, in Mao's phrase. ISIS has been making huge progress in the Sunni areas of Iraq. The Al Anbar province, where I fought for a year in 2003 and 2004, it doesn't trust, Al Anbar and the Sunnis there don't trust the Shia-dominated government in Baghdad.
And that's the biggest problem, you're saying, that the insurgents, they do have some popular support in their Sunni Muslim areas.
And that's one of the reasons they've been able to achieve such remarkable success, devouring a slice of Iraq the size of the state of Maryland in really just in this calendar year.
John Noggle, author of Knife Fights, a memoir of modern war in theory and practice. Please follow us on Twitter for the latest headlines at CBS Radio News. And I'm at Dan Raviv.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with the correspondents who cover the news. The CBS News Weekend Roundup, after this short break.
I'm Lex Friedman. I run my own business, so I know from experience, hiring new employees can be tough. Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites, and now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 50-plus job sites, including Craigslist, LinkedIn, and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 200,000 businesses. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/WSJ. That's ZipRecruiter.com/WSJ. One more time, to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/WSJ.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Revie.
Let's continue with retired Lieutenant Colonel John Noggle, veteran of the two Gulf Wars against Iraq, author of a new book on military strategy called Knife Fights. You heard he's very concerned about advances on land in Iraq by ISIS. And Lieutenant Colonel Noggle, in Syria, the U.S. and allies such as Saudi Arabia started bombing ISIS last month, but we don't have anyone seriously fighting them on the ground.
We have nobody on the ground, and we're really in a difficult place in Syria because we don't like the Assad government of Syria, which is, as you suggested, Shiite-dominated, supported by Iran, a government that uses chemical weapons against its own people, as Saddam Hussein's did in Iraq. So we don't want Assad's forces to win. We also don't want ISIS to win. ISIS, a group that's so violent, it was expelled from Al-Qaeda. So we really are left without any good options in Syria, and I'm afraid our campaign to date has revealed that fact.
Lieutenant Colonel Noggle, considering your experience, wouldn't you, well, prefer that U.S. fighters go into Syria and actually push back ISIS?
That would be an extraordinary escalation. I'd be happy right now if we could just focus on the Iraq part of the fight, make sure we don't lose the Baghdad International Airport, and embed American advisors inside those Iraqi units. We could then push ISIS back at least to the borders of Syria. At that point, I think we need to think long and hard about what we want, what kind of government we want after Assad, after ISIS in Syria. We haven't done that first-level thinking yet.
It sounds like you'd be willing to turn away from the Syria mission, or at least delay it. Concentrate on Iraq, and then maybe it'll be the next president who'll have to think more deeply and act in Syria.
And I'd actually welcome a national debate on what Syria should look like as part of the next presidential election. So I think that's all exactly right. Right now, I'm so concerned about what's happening in Iraq that I think we need to take urgent action now to defend the government in Baghdad, to help it defeat ISIS with its fighters, but our advisors. And I think that doing so is going to put a lot of pressure on ISIS in Syria. Most importantly, it's going to eliminate the current narrative in the world of jihadis that ISIS is the hot ticket. ISIS is a startup right now, and it is recruiting all of the good talent in the terrorist world.
So your title is knife fights, and it reminds me of that old expression of don't bring a knife to a gunfight. So choose the right weapon. In Iraq, we have the advisors and the bombing. It makes sense, or we have to do more in Iraq?
No, we have to do a lot more in Iraq, a lot more advisors. So the 1,600 or so advisors we currently have on the ground in Iraq are not part of the fighting. They're not doing combat advising. They're headquarters forces, and they're helping with training far from the actual battlefield. I think we need to increase those number of advisors by a factor of about 10. We probably need 15,000 advisors in Iraq right now, not 1,500. But we would absolutely have to accept more risk. There would be casualties, and I am talking about friends of mine.
Retired Lieutenant Colonel John Noggle, your latest book is called Knife Fights. Thanks for discussing the fight against ISIS.
It's a tough fight, but it's an important one.
Now, in this country, sexting, a trend that's actually sweeping the Western world. Teenagers using their phones to take and send photos of themselves naked or almost naked. Sexual come-ons, with usually no one advising the kids about possible dangers. Hannah Rosen at The Atlantic has a cover story called Why Teens Sext. She spoke with Steve Kathan, who anchors the CBS World News Roundup on weekday mornings.
You focused particularly on a place in Virginia where there was a scandal.
Yes, completely average American place, middle America, place like any other in the country. Nothing particular about it. And what happened was the parents woke up and the police woke up one morning to an Instagram page which had a picture of 100 girls from the high school and the middle school. So what do you do?
What do you do?
Well, I kind of followed the police's lead. What they did on that first day was go immediately to the school and start interviewing people. And they started with the girls because that's whose pictures were on the page. And they kept asking the question, well, do you know anybody else who has a naked picture of a minor on their phone? And everybody said yes. And so pretty soon they had dozens of kids in the office and bins full of cell phones. And what they were realizing, which is what all of us are realizing, is that it's totally common. So you've got a third of American teenagers who say they sext, send nude pictures to each other.
And you tried to find out in asking them why they do it. Is it a peer pressure thing? Is it just what kids do?
The latter is largely true. It's just what kids do. The vast, vast majority say they sext because they're in a relationship. It's just something you do if you're in a relationship. And then there's this minority of what the researchers called pressured sexters, and this particularly applies to girls, which is people who send sext because someone asked them 10, 15, 20 times, oh, you're so beautiful, send me a picture. I really want to see a picture. It's not somebody you are in a relationship with, have any particular trust with. It's just a guy keeps asking and asking and asking, and finally you send it, and that's likely to cause you problems.
What's the takeaway in your story for parents? I mean, they have to deal with these issues on a one-on-one basis with their teens or young people.
Sexting does not cause sexual dynamics, it reveals them. And so when you see a picture, before you start confiscating your child's phone and basically freaking out, just take a pause and consider this an opportunity to learn more. Who's at the other end of that sext? How old is your kid? What does the picture look like? What kind of kid do you have? Is a kid who's likely to be very vulnerable to pressure or not? So just look at it as an opportunity, not as a disaster.
That's Hannah Rosen of The Atlantic. I'm Steve Kathan, CBS News.
Pope Francis is hinting at more reforms in the Roman Catholic Church. Just 1 year and 7 months after becoming its leader, he's allowed a highly controversial committee at the Vatican on family life to say that gay people have gifts to offer the church and homosexual partnerships can have merit. Conservative cardinals are objecting. We have a report from CBS News correspondent Alan Pizzi in Rome.
Pope Francis told the 200 bishops to speak frankly and without fear. What they've argued out at the halfway point is nothing short of revolutionary. The bishops conceded the church must find ways to welcome and accept gays, unmarried, and divorced couples. It was a striking departure from the church's previous rejection of all those living in sin. The church is starting to follow the Pope's lead in tailoring the message for today's more secular world, according to Washington's Cardinal Donald Wuerl.
We're dealing with a different climate, a different moral climate, a different intellectual climate. And given that, we have to find ways of speaking so that the church's teaching gets a hearing.
Church doctrine won't change, but there are reports of fierce resistance from conservatives, but commentator and author John Thavis thinks that Francis will prevail.
I think what we're seeing here at the Synod of Bishops is the church as an institution finally getting on this Pope's wavelength.
The final text won't be approved until October next year, but for a 2,000-year-old institution that normally moves at a glacial pace,
What's emerged so far indicates a seismic shift into 21st century realities. Alan Pizzi, CBS News, Vatican City.
Up next, encryption on your phone to foil the government. And later, what drives Vladimir Putin?
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Ravine.
We all became aware because of the Edward Snowden leaks last year that the National Security Agency has the ability to track all cell phones, listen to conversations, and read emails, though that should not happen in the U.S. without court warrants. Some people buying new smartphones want them to come with encryption that would block the NSA and other government agencies from prying. Here's CBS News correspondent Bob Orr.
Apple has been unveiling a new generation of devices with bigger screens, sharper cameras, and faster processors. But it's Apple's new privacy protections that worry law enforcement. The latest operating system from the tech giant and competing software from Google allow people to permanently lock their smartphones. Only the user knows the security code. Apple and Google say they can't break that code, and neither can police, even with a court order. FBI Director James Comey warned this could allow criminals and terrorists to permanently hide their files.
It's the equivalent of a closet that can't be opened, a safe deposit box that can't be opened, a safe that can't ever be cracked.
The new privacy features come in response to a public backlash against broad government surveillance. In marketing its new system, Apple openly boasts about unbreakable encryption, saying we wouldn't be able to comply with a wiretap order even if we wanted to. And in a more direct response to the FBI warning, Google issued this statement saying people previously used safes and combination locks to keep their information secure. Now they use encryption. But Comey says this is about more than protecting the rights of the phone user.
I suggest to you that homicide cases could be stalled, suspects walked free, child exploitation not discovered and prosecuted. Justice may be denied because of a locked phone or an encrypted device.
Comey's asking smartphone manufacturers now to take a step back and change course. But Apple and Google are complying with current law, and they say they're simply responding to the public's demand for better privacy protection.
That from CBS's Bob Orr. Now our transportation correspondent Jeff Pagaz on a change that many people who fly on airlines welcomed. They're allowed to use their smartphones even during takeoff and landing. But some airline employees want that change canceled.
Passengers have embraced the idea of having access to their portable electronic devices. Sandra Gitlin travels for business.
We get on planes. Every minute is precious to us.
But the Flight Attendants Union is now fighting to get the FAA to change course on the rules. The union is pleading its case before a three-judge panel in the U.S. Court of Appeals. They say last year the FAA improperly cleared passengers to use small electronics during takeoffs and landings. They also say the devices can distract passengers from safety announcements and even become dangerous. Amanda DeRay represents the flight attendants.
iPads, tablets, any sort of portable electronic device, laptops, they can all become projectiles during times of turbulence. And during takeoff and landing, those are the two most critical phases of flight.
In the court proceeding, a Justice Department lawyer representing the FAA called the flight attendant's case much ado about nothing.
The projectile risks posed by cell phones are no greater than the risks posed by the books that everyone knows you could have out during takeoff and landing all along.
As it stands now, passengers can use smartphones, tablets, and e-readers from takeoff through landing in airplane mode or connected to the plane's in-flight Wi-Fi. The Department of Transportation and the Federal Communications Commission are now considering whether to go a step further and allow in-flight cell phone calls as well.
CBS's Jeff Pagaz. Let's consider Russia's President Vladimir Putin. He had a hero's welcome in Serbia the other day, showing Russian influence in Eastern Europe remains strong, even as Ukraine hangs in the balance. A civil war killing people, but deciding nothing. We turn to the author of a new book, Putin's Kleptocracy, Professor Karen Dawisha. What's going on in Ukraine? Is that mostly about Putin fearing that Ukraine would turn toward the West, become part of Western Europe? Is that the main factor there?
I think it's the main factor. And not just turning toward the West, but becoming democratic. Ukraine's just put into effect laws banning Yanukovych-era officials from staying in power. anti-corruption laws. I mean, that's anathema for Putin.
Anathema. And a lot of the wealth that Russians have since the fall of communism comes from natural resources, including oil and natural gas. Now, the price of oil has been falling down into the low 80s per barrel. That's probably hurting Russia and Putin's friends, do you think?
The stock prices for major Russian oil and gas companies have really been plummeting. They can't balance their budget for anything under $100 a barrel. And as you say, we're in the low 80s. So they're down 20% of budget funding.
So anyone who fears that Russia's getting stronger maybe should look at that and see economically they're not.
Right, although they are increasing their defense spending. So it's going to come out of health, education, welfare spending. The people are going to get weaker. People are going to get poorer.
And in his foreign policies, is Putin always on the opposite side from the United States?
They did try to have good relations, and we had progress on START, for example, arms reduction treaties in the first Obama administration. But, you know, once Obama started to focus on corruption and sanctions and stuff like that, that was it for Putin. There was no way that he was going to have a policy that was anything but anti-Obama. In fact, Prime Minister Medvedev, former President Medvedev, said that Obama's statements showed signs of mental aberrations. So, I mean, really personal attacks on Obama, and Obama hasn't been saying many nice things about Putin either.
So it's a return to the Cold War in many ways.
Yeah.
Well, we need to understand Putin and where his power comes from. A lot of it is money, of course, and corruption. And this book's called Putin's Kleptocracy. That's the author, Karen Dawisha. Thank you very much, Professor.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Now our Weekend Roundup commentator, Charles Grodin.
I have what some people see as a flaw, but it's my impression that most people see it as an asset. It doesn't matter who you are, what you do, or how much money you have. I speak to everyone the same way, respectfully. It's not a choice. It's just the way it is. This has gotten me a lot of friends and some enemies. I'm particularly thinking of a famous movie director whom, when I met him, within 2 minutes said, "I know I should like you, but I don't." I've since asked about him with some people who worked with him. They said he expected to be treated differently than other people. This evidently was also true when I met a cousin of the Queen of England. I deeply offended her by saying, "I've never met royalty before. What's the main focus of your life?" She saw that as an incredibly rude question and let me know it. I could have, but I didn't say, "Royalty started by someone winning a war and declaring themselves king." I say, treat everyone the same. You'll have a happier life. I'm Charles Grode for the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Thanks for being with us, and anytime you want to hear us, please do a web search for CBS Weekend Roundup. You'll find our podcasts also on iTunes and other podcast services, and our app for your smartphone is CBS Radio News. I'm Dan Revive. Bye.
You've been listening to the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The program is produced in the Washington Bureau of CBS News. The executive producer is Howard Arenstein.